Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to The Times. To find out more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and if you're wondering why I'm so chipper today, it's just because I'm just back from a trip to the US and the Sloan Analytics Conference, where we could talk analytics for the next 45 minutes, but we won't. Instead, we'll have a normal Game Podcast, and I am excited because this week I am joined on the panel by Tony Cascarino, who was just telling me about his favorite DJ, who's a guy named Robert Elms. Is that right?
Yeah.
If you and Cass are like-minded people, you can go and find him. So I'm sure he's streaming somewhere out there. And also, I'm joined by Matt Hughes, who I'm assuming does not listen to the radio ever. What do you listen to?
Oh, I don't know. Radio Free.
Oh, my God.
Classical music?
Yeah, in the car.
There you go. And joining us from his place up north, where he's apparently just had a large box of women's clothes delivered to his house, it's Rory K. Smith.
For my wife. Yeah, for my
wife. Coming up, we'll be discussing the return of Rafa Benitez at Newcastle United, chatting through all the games of the weekend. But first, let's start with the magic of the FA Cup. It's Arsenal and Watford. QZ, I'm going to begin with you because it's been 2 years since Arsenal lost a game in the FA Cup, which is just one of those stats that's kind of meaningless. All it tells you is they won the last two FA Cups. But it kind of gets sort of chucked aside by, once again, talk of crisis and whatever else. What was more of a blow, getting knocked out here or that first leg against Barcelona? I mean, what gives you more of a sense of another season of waste, if you think that's what it is?
I'd say it's neither of those, actually. I think it's their Premier League form is the biggest issue, I think, really. And it's just yesterday's result is the accumulation of just more bad news. And I don't think crisis is quite the right word. It's just status at Arsenal. Mm. Nothing ever changes. They get into good positions to challenge, then they fade away. And other than the FA Cup, they can't clinch the deal. Obviously, the Barcelona result was disappointing. But realistically, I don't think anyone at the club thought they were going to win the Champions League or even get through two legs against Barcelona. It's kind of a semi-implosion in the Premier League, going out of the cup, the best chance of the competition. It's just yet more bad news and more angst for those fans who, as they're always reminding us, pay the highest prices in the country.
Cass, it's hard to kind of escape the sense of deja vu, although Wenger came out in the game, or afterwards, and talked about how they outplayed Watford, they deserved more, Watford had only two chances and they converted both of them. Is this nonsense, or I don't want to say nonsense, but is it kind of like, yeah, you should have more chances because you're at home, because you're a much better team. You don't have the lucidity to turn them into clear-cut chances that you convert.
Well, I don't think anyone before the game would have felt that Arsenal wouldn't have had more opportunities. And if you're going to win away games, sometimes you do what you do, and Watford converted the ones they did. Arsenal's got to look at his own team and think, well, some of the people I'm buying and he's bought to that football club have not converted their chances. And you just
said, names.
Well, Giroud's had a lean period, hasn't he, of late? Welbeck's come back.
Giroud's goals per minute.
Okay.
Wenger would tell you.
This is Groundhog Day, what we've talked about before. Look, they've lost to Swansea at home. That was a real big blow to their title chances. Then they go to Old Trafford and play terribly. And in between that, we've had obviously the Champions League performance, and getting knocked out in the FA Cup by Watford. So there's been a continuation of really poor performances. He clearly is not sure about his best team now. He's changed that forward line on numerous occasions over the last few weeks, trying to find something. And not one of his players has got to the level that really is what Arsenal are about. I think Theo struggled when he's played. He's come off the bench, looked like he's absolutely nowhere near on the fringes of games. He played at Old Trafford, didn't get a kick in that league game. Back to your point about Watford. Did we really think that Watford were going to dominate the play and win the game and have host of chances? No, they'd done it in a way that probably Swansea did, because it's deja vu in the way Swansea won the game. They won the game with very few chances and converted them.
Roy, our colleague Henry Winter, who was your colleague years ago as well when you worked at the Telegraph, he came out he tweeted after the game, basically, and I am paraphrasing his tweet. He said that Arsenal need a review, an inquest, and it's got a concern the dressing room, the boardroom, the medical room. You know, and I tweeted back and I said, so basically everyone. Is it that simple, Rory? Or is that just kind of like our reaction? I have to say, I totally agree with Henry there. But what I wonder is, are there actually some positives in the way Arsenal, to take from Arsenal's season?
Oof, that's taken counterintuitive to breaking point, that. I mean, there are, obviously. Arsenal have got a wonderful squad. They've got lots of brilliant players. They make a lot of money. They've got all off the pitch. There's nothing wrong with Arsenal at all, I don't think. I think the issue is whether in Wenger, it's not even that you'd solve it necessarily by getting rid of Wenger and bringing a new coach, and that might help. But it's more that for 10 years, that, and we've had this conversation a million times. We seem to have it about a dozen times a season, whenever Arsenal lose a game. But for 10 years, there's basically not been that ruthlessness at Arsenal. There's not been that sense that if they fail, that the players might sort of be out on their ear, they might be deemed not good enough, because Wenger is so loyal and so faithful to his players.
Actually, you make a really good point there, because I was thinking about this, right? And sometimes clubs are too quick to get away or to get rid of guys, right? Or to write them off as failures. And can you think of guys who came to Arsenal, didn't perform, and then were kind of chucked out on their ear a year later? For example, I don't know, like, compared to like Chelsea, they signed Felipe Luis for a lot of money. He has a season where he wasn't even that bad, I thought. But then Mourinho decides he doesn't like him, and boom, he's out of there. And obviously it's difficult for Arsenal because they make a lot of money. Their players are high earners, so it's more difficult to shift them. But can you guys think of examples like that? I mean, does that support your ruthlessness argument?
There's a couple of kind of smaller ones, isn't there? Sebastian Scolacci, people like that. You know, there's a couple of kind of low-profile players who've been brought in, not worked out, and
Joel Campbell?
Well, but Campbell's been around for...
Yeah, but then they had to take him back.
Campbell for 7 years.
Right.
I think the issue with Arsenal is that after a while that sort of seeps into the club's culture.
Oh, sorry, we had one from Cass, Emmanuel Frimpong.
Emmanuel Frimpong?
He stood by him for a while, Frimpong.
I'm scratching now, I'm really scratching my head.
Jose Reyes didn't stay for that long, did he? And Arshavin eventually was bombed
out. Arshavin was there for a good 5 years.
Yeah, there's a sort of softness from Wenger that permeates the whole club. They're soft in front of goal, they're soft at the back, and his decisions are soft. He kept giving contracts to Abu Dhabi, for goodness sake. It's not a charity. He was never going to be a Premier League footballer. He gave a new deal to Arteta and Flamini and Riziki when they're basically all past their best. I think it's ludicrous, and there's got to be, I think Chelsea, clearly decisions they've made have been wrong as well. They've written off players far too quickly and are now suffering for that, but there's got to be a middle ground.
Let's talk Watford, Roy, because you always say that for a team to be successful, they need a strong British spine. And, of course, they have that in Cathcart, Watson and Deeney.
I do. I'm famously always saying that teams need a strong British spine. I know Watford are... I mean, they've sunk a little bit down the lead. I think they're 13th or 14th now, but perfectly safe from relegation. Kite's done a brilliant job. The Pozzos have kind of shown that they do know what they're doing in the transfer market. They've turned Watford into a side that not only kind of can survive in the Premier League, but looks comfortable playing in that style, that sort of counter-attacking style. It's been a brilliant season for Watford, and more generally in terms of the FA Cup, it's great that the three of the four semi-finalists, and potentially West Ham as well, are teams to whom winning the FA Cup, you know, Arsenal, it's meant a lot, but it was a consolation prize the last 2 years. It's a consolation prize when Chelsea or City or United or Liverpool win it. It's great day out, but that. It's always kind of either an addition to the lead or to Europe, or it's a, well, at least we've won that, that'll do sort of thing. If Everton, Palace, West Ham, or Watford win the FA Cup, it'll be one of the proudest days in their history, and that's brilliant for the competition.
Hughesy, what do you make of the way they play and the way Kike Sanchez-Flores lines them up? Because people look at it and say, like, oh, look, it's just counter-attacking. And it was in this game, obviously. But it's also two center forwards, which not many teams do. And also, Kike Sanchez-Flores didn't come with the reputation of being that sort of safety-first manager, necessarily.
I don't think it's safety-first. I think it's making the best out of what you've got and tailoring your game plan towards your opponents. I've been to Vicarage Road a few times this season. They start games really quickly. They are attacking. They may not linger in possession in the way that Arsenal do, but they get bodies forward, and they've got so much pace in the team. I think they're actually quite exciting to watch.
Cass, we saw a goal from Guidiora, which just looked to me like he just struck the life out of a goal, and it was great because well, first of all, I know some people are can be unkind to Robbie Savage, but I was listening to it and I thought, like, he just genuinely got excited talking about it. He compared it to Stephen Reid's goal in a game that he played in. I remember I tweeted about it. All these people tweeted in other great goals from the back from years past, Vasily Rats and stuff like that. Can you just explain technically, how do you hit a ball so hard? Have you ever done that?
I could do a lot of things for you, Gab, and I could talk about heading, but I've never, ever struck a ball like that, especially with my right foot. The technique has to be absolutely perfect, and he comes onto it, he keeps his head down. I mean, it's very important, obviously, to keep your head down as you strike a ball. Comes over the top of the...
So I want to ask about that, about the head down, because obviously that's I think everybody who's played it, even as kids, like, you're told that. But then I was also told that this head down thing is just something that applies to children. That if you're a professional athlete, getting your knee over it is a lot more important. You can have your head all the way back, and it doesn't matter if you're coordinated enough. And in fact, you can get some sort of slingshot effect or something like that. Mario Bain told me that.
I think it's a bit of a combination of everything. You have to get all your body parts right, from your head to your knee to your shoulders. You're getting up. If your head is back, it's very hard to keep it low.
Unless you're really talented.
Well, and
elastic.
I can't remember seeing someone with their head. Yeah, exactly. Like Mr. Stretch. But it's an incredible strike where the guy's got himself perfectly balanced. He will hit that strike 1,000 times. He won't do what he did.
Do you remember ever hitting a ball that sweetly?
I think I've done it once or twice in training, but I think I've probably kicked 1,000 plus 2,000 strikes like that and never ever connected as well as he did. It was the perfect connection, something that he wouldn't be able to do again as well. Emulating that is nearly impossible, and it was beyond this Espirina before he even knew it. It was, I mean, you said Robbie Savage got excited, but how could you not? You're commentating.
No,
you expected to sort of, well, that was a decent strike, wasn't it? It was an amazing strike.
The guy's done, I presume, hundreds of games, and he's talking all the time. So, but you can tell when his voice gets,
And anyway, to be fair, there was two or three unbelievable goals this weekend, and that was one of them.
Yeah.
Less unbelievable was the Gabriel tackle on Troy Deeney early on. It's off the ground. It's two-footed. We'll probably go back to referees on the show a little bit, but I don't just want to pick on them all the time, but, like, Andre Mariner's right there. Does he see something different?
It's hard to understand what's going through his head, really, because not only is he off the ground with 2 feet, he connects really high as well. It's not just reckless. He actually connected. So, clear sending off from my perspective. And it's not the first time I've seen Gabriel lash out, lose his head. I thought actually his first season at Arsenal he was quite impressive and maybe could have been pushing Mertesacker a bit closer, but since he's come into the side recently, I think he's been appalling. The first goal yesterday he gave far too much space.
The long throw-in, wasn't it? With Deeney getting the flick on.
Too easy. He does make these rash challenges. Arsenal really missed Koscielny during his injury.
Right. Deeney appears to say, or to mouth afterwards, something like, if it was the other way around, it would be a red. In other words, had that been a Watford player on Olivier Giroud, say. The crowd, referees are human, blah, blah, blah. Are you buying this?
I do think that certain teams are more... There's probably evidence not only not to support what I'm about to say, but to directly contradict it. I don't know if it's the crowd necessarily, but I do wonder whether... And Van Gaal, what Van Gaal said bafflingly last week about... nice players shouldn't be getting sent off, but I do think referees are probably sort of subliminally influenced by their perception of people and teams. And as you say, there is no world in which that's not a red card, and it's bizarre that it wasn't as given as one. So I guess you do have to look for reasons. It could have been his line of sight. He maybe didn't kind of get quite the right handle on it. I don't know. Or it could be that he thought, well, you know, it's an Arsenal player. He was less prone to sending him off.
Right, moving on to Manchester United and West Ham. There were two big calls in this, and you know, let's start with the referees again. No, but not so much about the referees. It's about the managers, right? Bilic comes out afterwards and says that Rojo on Payet, and that was a tackle where Rojo slides in, maybe a little bit like shades of Delaney and Benteke, and sort of pulls out or tries to pull out, does catch him. The question is whether Payet was already going down and whether he should have been booked and blah, blah, blah. And the other one was on Martial's goal. Schweinsteiger runs into Randolph, the West Ham cup keeper. Now, Bilic goes out and says those are two Stonewall decisions that go against West Ham. And Van Gaal comes out, unsurprisingly, has a, you know, 180-degree differing view. He says Payet, quote, more or less dived. And he says that Michael Antonio picked up Bastian Schweinsteiger and threw him into Randolph. That goal should have stood. Usually, we're used to managers seeing things differently, right? Polar opposites. I'm wondering, though, would it have killed him if Van Gaal had said, meh, you know, that goal, we were kind of fortunate. I don't think Schweinsteiger did intentionally, but he did hinder the keeper, and that goal shouldn't have stood? Or would that be kind of mediatic suicide if he said that?
No, it wouldn't, but it's very rare, isn't it? I'm trying to think of examples of managers who are genuinely honest, and there aren't many.
Do you think he was not being honest on that one?
Honesty is maybe the wrong phrase, but he's.
Do you believe Antonio pushed Schweinsteiger into Randolph?
Of course not. I thought of those decisions, I thought the second one was clear cut. It was a foul. Schweinsteiger ran into him, even raised the elbow. It's clearly a deliberate intervention. The first one is more difficult because Payet is diving, and then there is contact. So is he diving to get contact, or is he diving to avoid Rojo sliding in? It's almost impossible to tell. So I've got sympathy with the referee for that one. No decision that you make there is going to be absolutely right. You could have given a penalty, you could have booked him, you could have given nothing, and all three of them would have been probably fair enough decisions, to be honest.
Cass, you've been in one or two penalty boxes when there was a set piece coming in. The running into the keeper thing, there's different levels of tolerance, certainly in England compared to perhaps your time in France and whatever. It's pretty standard fare, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's where the game is, that the lines of margins of success and failure are so fine. I mean, in normal action, I didn't really think too much about the incident with Schweinsteiger and the goalkeeper under normal time. It's only when you see the replays that you can then see Schweinsteiger completely takes out Randolph.
If there was an official behind the goal, he probably would have seen it. But, hey, they're lollipop men.
I mean, I looked up Friday night and Balassi's dive in the box against Reading with a few minutes to go, and then you're looking at Payet. Players are doing this deliberately, and managers are... I mean, Alan Pardew had the week before the Benteke incident, and this week he had his own player doing exactly the same thing, and you think, where is the game? The whole management, they won't accept handing over any advantage or saying that their player did anything wrong. We've got to a stage where basically the game's as dishonest as it's ever been, and even more so because the fine lines and margins between winning and losing are there for everybody to see.
Right. I correspond with a referee, and I think this referee might also have a soft spot for one of these two teams. But
is it Lee Mason?
No, it's not Lee Mason, funnily enough. But he said that actually, you know, Atkinson had a really, really good game. The Rojo on Payet, it was just such a difficult, difficult decision that, you know, really, it's damned if you do, damned if you don't. And then Schweinsteiger Randolph, he said, from what he was looking at, he said he couldn't have seen it. And so that maybe we should lay off the referees in this specific instant. He just had a tiny little go at Howard Webb, too, saying, like, you know, unless Howard has superhuman powers, he couldn't have seen either incident clearly himself. Are we a little harsh in this case if we have a go at Atkinson?
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? That as soon as the referees can get 99.9% of the decisions right, and if the two that they get wrong are two that could potentially change the game, and in this instance did kind of change the game, because obviously not given the foul on Payet and not spotting the what looked like, I've got to admit, the Schweinsteiger one, I didn't see it watching the game on TV. I didn't see it first time around. It took a couple of replays for me to genuinely think, that looks like a foul to me. But the thing is that it's the same with goalkeepers. The goalkeepers do everything right for 89 minutes. They make one mistake, terrible game. So same with referees, and that's kind of the problem. I, as you know, Gab, as I say every time we talk about referees, I don't like talking about referees.
Okay, so talk about football. Who deserved to win this game?
I think West Ham did. But I think a draw wasn't entirely unfair.
Guzzi?
Yeah, I'd agree. West Ham had far more chances and then maybe just ran out of steam slightly. I mean, United were better than against Liverpool, but that's such a low base that it doesn't really... It's hard to paint it as a big improvement.
It's strange.
You'd back West Ham in the replay, really, Upton Park, emotional night.
I found it very strange, and listening to the fans' reaction when players are getting the ball at Old Trafford now is quite... It's quite eye-opening, where the fact that you physically hear the fans wanting the player to pass the ball forward. So when a midfielder like Fellaini or Schneidlin, I know he didn't play the weekend, but they get the ball and they're looking to go backwards with the pass, you literally feel the tension at Old Trafford because the fans aren't wanting them to do that. That must have happened 10 times against West Ham yesterday, where the fans wanting the player to go forward thinking with his pass. But players who are getting the ball are so isolated all the time. Players are receiving the ball with no real option but to go backwards again.
But this is what I don't understand, though, because you have Rashford and Martial, right, who at the very least, you know, and Martial, I thought, had a good game. They're fast. They should be able to run into space or run across the back line. Like, as long as they're moving, there's always a target, right?
Gab, a lot of it has to come down to a piece of individual brilliance to get past somebody. I don't see numbers in the 18-yard box with United. I don't see an intention of a midfielder joining the forwards to create mayhem or more decisions for a player on the ball.
Okay, right. If you're Fellaini and you get the ball and there's a dude in front of you, so, and you're Fellaini, so you're like, all right, well, I'm not good enough to hit this ball to wherever Rashford and Martial are running to, but I am good enough to turn my rear end into whoever is pressing me, knock it back to Blint, and he's good enough, and he's not going to be marked because he's behind me, and West Ham only have one center forward who can't mark Blint and the other center half at the same time, and then that dude knocks it into space, right? I mean, it's what Tony Pulis does, right? And it works. And if you have the right players...
But you're Manchester United. You can't have individual isolated going for forward-thinking passing. Because you're saying they're Blind. Blind's only option is going to be probably feeding it out wide because Martial's hugging the line. He's got Rashford who's standing central on his own. No,
he shouldn't be standing.
Player.
He should be moving,
well,
right?
Moving, but he's trying to find a yard or two of space, Gab. But the problem is that no midfielder for United will leave their areas to get into forward... Passing right. move, so you get extra
well,
bodies.
Isn't that's? I mean, of the three who played yesterday,
Herrera.
That's Herrera's job,
yeah, it's
right?
Herrera, but
you don't want Michael Carrick sprinting forward because he's going to come back next week. So
I can.
So
totally
it's a coaching
see,
problem, is what you're saying.
I totally see why their goal stats are so down.
It was galling how much better they became when Schweinsteiger came on. I mean, they pointed this out on TV last night too. But it was evident if you were watching it. All of a sudden, you have somebody whose brain seems to be thinking a little differently, even though Schweinsteiger is certainly not fast or particularly athletic, and he's had all those injuries. It was working so much better.
Hmm. Well, because he can see a pass and spot it, but. Defensively, he's so limited now by his physical
restrictions. But that's why it seems stupid to me to play Schweinsteiger. I think at this stage, if you're going to play him, you would play Schweinsteiger. You don't play Fellaini, and maybe you play some 4-1-4-1 variation where you have Herrera and Schweinsteiger. And
playing Herrera deeper is the answer. Yeah, playing Herrera with Carrick or
Schweinsteiger. These pieces just don't fit together.
Well, I think a lot of the problem is that the player, actually, I really like Juan Mata. I know his numbers are good. He's beautiful to watch. He's a great guy. But I think he's just too slow to sort of the way United historically and the fans want them to play. He's always demands too much time on the ball.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Often comes back onto his left foot, and if you're wanting quick ball down the channels in the way that United have over the last 20 years, I don't think he's the kind of guy to do that.
But then there's Van Gaal's selections as well. Someone pointed out to me last week that if you look at Schneidlin, they brought Schneidlin in to kind of be the energy in midfield next to either Schweinsteiger or Carrick, who were sort of, you'd struggle to have to say that Carrick and Schweinsteiger between them, you play the two together, are a really dynamic midfield. They're a beautiful, sort of elegant midfield, not especially dynamic. So Schneidlin's meant to provide the energy. But Van Gaal never plays Schneidlin in the games where you need someone like Schneidlin. His selections, Van Gaal's, you know, one of the best coaches of the last 20 years, but his team selections at United, even with the injuries, have more often than not been completely baffling.
Hughesy, do you want to give the Mighty Irons some love here? Well, you spent time with one of them at the end of last week. I did.
The very interesting afternoon with Angelo Agbona, who was a top man. He gave me insight into what is happening at that club, and we saw it again yesterday in terms of their team spirit and energy and their fearlessness, really. They took the game to United. Obviously, they would want to win the game, but a replay at Upton Park on a Tuesday, Wednesday night next week will be something that their fans will really relish.
Blackpool on West Ham Pirates obviously having an absurd season. If I were allowed a vote, and if Riyad Mahrez didn't exist, I would seriously consider him for Player of the Year. But that free kick, you're going to shake your head. Now you're going to tell me that you've never scored a free kick.
Well, I'm shaking my head because I think you're going to ask me that.
Could you explain how he... No, I realise you weren't that sort of player, but you've played with guys who did that.
Yeah, right? Dennis Irwin was fantastically good at...
What's involved in that? Because, you know, Dennis Irwin, obviously, a great player, but, you know, we're not talking, you know, Zidane or even Miralem Pjanic. Is it as simple as, like, players who can do this well are players who practice for a long time, who almost have that... It's kind of like if you play snooker or billiards or whatever... That's kind of the principle behind it, all the parts moving together.
I was lucky enough to watch Dennis Irwin practice. Obviously, he had a period at Man United where he couldn't get on them because of Beckham. And I always used to think, God, you've got to get Dennis on some of these free kicks. Because I'd watched him, trained with him, and he could get the ball up and down. And had a real belief that he could do that as well. He had a confidence. He was two-footed. Dennis could do left and right foot. He would whip them up and down over the wall.
Both feet?
Yeah, he could do both
feet. Like Andy Bremer?
Yeah.
Wow.
He was exceptional with his 2 feet, left and right. And I always felt confident that Dennis could do what Payet can, you know, would put them in the top corner, make keepers, make saves. Yeah, there was a lot of hard work. Practice, he would be out, you know, doing free kicks after training. But the innermost, I believe, is that they know they can do it. They really believe they can do it. That confidence to step up and say, give me this. And that focus, having that focus at that period. Because some people think that, you know, if you could see that Payet was so concentrated and focused about what he wanted to do on that ball and how he wanted to show everyone that, to produce the right strike and get it up and down so quick. There's a level of concentration, definitely.
What I'm curious about is how do you develop that skill, because I'm assuming when you were a little boy or coming through the ranks, you probably didn't go and practice that skill.
No,
Irwin probably did.
Yeah, he did. And
I'm just wondering how many people kind of get typecast to be type.
Can I just ask you something? Tell you something. Look, when you're in a group of 24 players, so you go training, you quite quickly recognise who are the 2, 3, 4 guys that on free kicks are better than others. It's a bit like saying, well, Tony can head the ball better than blah.
Yeah, but I understand that once you're a pro, right? Mm. But for example, Zlatan is about your size, right?
Yeah.
He can do that. And I'm guessing that part of it is because when he was 14 or 15 years old, his youth coaches didn't just say, okay, Zlatan, you go in the box and we'll try to, you know, ping balls off your head the way perhaps coaches did with you.
Yeah.
You weren't encouraged to pursue that when you were a kid.
And we weren't told where we'd have to hit the ball. You know, our foot connecting with the ball had to be in certain positions, because if you hit the ball on the top, it's going to go low. So they learnt how to get it up and down by the precise part of the ball. If you take the ball as a circle, where your foot needs to get round, that gives you a chance. But it's still, you know, saying it and doing it are two different things.
Gab, can I just make a quick point on that Paye free kick?
Yes, please.
If De Gea doesn't have a wall, he doesn't score.
Oh, you're going to have a go at De Gea?
I'm having a go at the concept of the wall. He was 35 yards out.
Right.
There is no reason in that situation to have a wall at all. All it serves to do is to provide the taker with a target and to obscure the goalkeeper's line of vision. De Gea did not need a wall. He needed to stand in the middle of his goal and watch the ball fly at him from 35 yards. He's one of the best goalkeepers in the world. He would have saved it.
We're going to talk about the return of one of our favorite people in football, Rafa Benitez. I hope you gentlemen in the studio will understand if I start with the man who helped Rafa write a book about football.
Touting around the Gallagher end all weekend.
Exactly.
Well, I'm doing tonight. I'll be in the away end with lots of copies.
Rory, this guy was managing Real Madrid until a few months ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a very good chance that Newcastle will get relegated, given that he didn't assemble these players. He gets uncomfortable if he's got players that he didn't put together. There's a lot of things that can go wrong. If he gets relegated, it's still a blot. People still bring up, oh, look, how can Alan Shearer talk about football on television? You know, that fool got Newcastle relegated back in the day, right? There's a very good chance that he's going to hurt his rep rather than help his rep. I'm sure he's got a clause whereby he can leave if they get relegated or whatever. But even if he stays up, it's still Newcastle. It's still all those people who Shearer mentioned, from Ashley to Carr to Charnley. This is still the environment he's working in. Why does he do that? Why doesn't he wait a couple months more, see what other jobs are out there? I mean, he's still Rafa Benitez.
It's partly that he really wanted to work in England, which is partly because of the Premier League being the place to be, and partly because obviously his family's remained in England and he's been working in Italy and Spain. So I think that was a big factor. I think Rafa's always had a thing about Newcastle being a kind of a properly big club within their city, within their context. So if you spoke to Rafa about and said to him you could take either Newcastle or Southampton, say, to most of us, Southampton look like a more kind of upwardly mobile, more sensible, more safe, more stable club. But to Rafa, I think that the kind of just the sheer size of Newcastle would appeal to him. Well known Rafa, he'll have made a sort of detailed analysis of which jobs might come up in the summer. And I think he's looked at it and thought that in terms of jobs in England, there wouldn't be anything that would appeal to him more than Newcastle in the Premier League. And the timing was such that he had to take Newcastle when they might go out of the Premier League in order to try and get Newcastle in the Premier League next season. And I think that's the logic. He will know it's a risk. He's not stupid. I think he might be underplaying that he will still be associated with the failure if they go down. At the same time, I wonder if he thinks it's kind of his last chance to get a truly big English club. If it doesn't work out, if they do get relegated, he has this break clause. All indications are he's got no intentions of managing in the Championship. At that point, you wonder, does he then start to look further afield for his next job? Does he accept that he's had his final sort of swan song in England if they're relegated? If not, he's in charge of Newcastle next year. He can build his side. He'll get money. He can make it look like a Rafa Benitez team over the next couple of years. And he can try and build something. And all, you know, there's this idea that Newcastle fans are incredibly demanding. I don't think they are. I think they're among the least demanding fans in the country.
No, I think we've knocked that stupid stereotype on the head so many times on this show.
So if you're Benitez and 18 months down the line, you've got Newcastle to ninth, I don't know, next season, and you've got a team that's playing decent football, intense, hard working, all that stuff that Benitez's teams do, you're looked upon as having done a really good job at Newcastle. So I think he's looked at it and realised there is a big downside. But he's obviously felt that the upside outweighs it.
It still is extraordinary, though, isn't it? From what you were saying, Rory, you're sort of suggesting that this is his last chance in England. His two jobs in England, at Liverpool and Chelsea, he's done incredibly well, really, also, if you contrast his approach to that of, say, Brendan Rodgers, David Moyes, both out of work, both keen to get back in, their stocks are much lower than Rafa's, I would say, at the moment, and they've not gone anywhere near this job or any other job. So
is it maybe a process of elimination thing, in the sense that you're not going to go back to Liverpool anytime soon? He can't manage United or Everton for obvious reasons. Chelsea looks like they have their managers. He's been turned down by Spurs more times than he can count. And plus, you know, so that even if Pochettino leaves, it's unlikely he's going to go there. Kind of leaves, of the biggest clubs, unless I'm forgetting, City have their manager too. That leaves Arsenal, and there's no guarantee that Arsene Wenger will ever leave that job.
I think he's looked at it without question. That's absolutely right. So Rafa sees himself, whether he... And I have to be quite careful with stuff I say about Rafa, because Rafa is a very divisive figure. It's interesting that a couple of years ago he was linked with Newcastle, 2 or 3 years ago, I think, he was linked with
and
Newcastle.
And West Ham last year too, was he?
They offered him the job,
West Ham.
They offered Rafa the job
at West Bilic. Ham.
Yeah.
And a lot of fans, both at West Ham and at Newcastle, kind of kicked off and said, I don't like Benitez, not good enough, failed at Liverpool, failed at Chelsea, failed at Napoli, right. All this stuff, failed at Inter Milan. And it's amazing, and I find that genuinely amazing. I know Rafa and I like him, and I am kind of partisan towards him, I'm not afraid to admit that, but I find it genuinely astonishing that supporters of a club like West Ham can look at a man who's won the European Cup, 2 Europa Leagues and 2 Spanish titles and think, no, he's not good enough for us. I find that absolutely astonishing. What's interesting with Newcastle is that this time around there has been almost unanimous support for the fact that they've got Benitez in, which says something about kind of A, how far the club have fallen and how maybe that lends a perspective. But yes, Rafa sees himself as a Champions League coach, or a coach who should kind of be competing to get into the Champions League. He has taken Newcastle because he is aware that none of those jobs are going to come up for him in the foreseeable future, which means you have to then look sort of below that and see, right, well, how can I still be in charge of a big club, not take a job that is, for want of a better word, beneath me? And he's looked at Newcastle and thought that if he can keep them up, he has a big job at a big club.
I went to Rafa's first home game when he was Chelsea interim manager, and they played City. And they'd just been beaten 3-0 by Juve away from home in the Champions League. And Chelsea were in disarray. And Rafa's first game, I was thinking, how is he going to change this team around and make them look, you know, much harder to beat and have something different? And they drew 0-0 against City at home. And to be fair, Chelsea didn't try and really win the game. I think Rafa was so concerned about just keeping a clean sheet. And I thought he'd done a great job for Chelsea in that time he was there, running the ship against a lot of anger from the Chelsea fans who did not want him as manager. But he managed it. I just thought, fair play to you. You know, that hostile atmosphere on a weekly basis at the Bridge, he managed it and done really well with Chelsea. And I think Newcastle got a big coup. I think Rafa's a really quality manager that I hope I'm not wrong. I hope he stays even if they go down. We're all talking here that he's got his contract. I hope Rafa would stay, because I think for Newcastle and for him, there'll be a lot more pluses.
Let's talk about the guy he replaced, Steve McClaren. I like Steve McClaren as a person, and the times I've met him, I like him a lot.
Stop saying that. Everybody's saying that. Do you know what?
It's important, though.
On the Beeb the other week, Martin Keown, who had worked under him, he couldn't have given a bigger indictment against Steve McClaren. He said, I've worked with Steve. He said, yeah, fantastic coach. Not a manager for me.
What surprises me tremendously is that if you look at his jobs after Twente the first time around, right, they all ended badly. He went to Wolfsburg, that ended badly. He returned to Twente, that ended badly. He went to Nottingham Forest, that didn't last very long, but that didn't end well either. He went to QPR in that...
Coaching, QPR.
Coaching, yeah.
Right, okay. Or QPR in the Premier League? No. So, like, that obviously didn't turn into a job or some... Didn't have a massive impact there. Then he went to Derby, where, admittedly, I don't follow the Championship, but I did read up on this a little bit. They were in first place, and he won, like... 2 of his last 10 games. Somebody told me, oh, but somebody named Chris Martin got injured, who's not the comedian nor the singer. It's a footballer in the Championship, apparently. That's great. It still doesn't explain how you win 2 out of 10 games and you drop out of first place, right? You're probably more familiar with Chris Martin than I am. Is he some Ibrahimovic-type figure in the Championship?
He's a good goal scorer at the Championship. Yeah.
Does it justify you winning 2 games out of 10 to end the season and dropping from 1st to 6th?
No, but it wouldn't help.
I mean, he gets the Newcastle job, and they even put him on the board. And that's odd, isn't it?
It was very odd. He was on the board and clearly meaningless, given he's lost his job 10 months later. I think what everyone says, at the risk of repeating it, is that he's a very good coach, and he's lacking as a manager. He's too nice, too soft on some of the players. I remember covering his England team, and it was cringeworthy. He was the classic sort of trendy uncle, called the players with their nicknames, Wazza, Stevie G, Bex, Scorsese. All this, and it was embarrassing, really. Because he was over promoted and hadn't managed at the highest level, he was almost trying too hard. It backfired pretty badly.
Would you have him managing Huddersfield?
Not at the moment. We've got quite a good manager.
Okay, who is it?
David Wagner. He used to be Klopp's number 2 at Dortmund, as I'm sure you know.
Wow! No, I did not know that.
You
should
look,
I had no
you should,
idea.
And look below the
world correspondent.
Yeah. It's difficult. It's difficult because there's only so many hours in the day, and I only have so much space in my hard drive.
Someone told me the other day, someone who watches a lot of the Championship, said that Huddersfield are the best side to watch in the Championship under Wagner.
They're good at playing football, not great at winning matches, unfortunately.
Well, but that's still.
But we're getting better.
That's good, right?
Is Andy Booth still there?
I think he's some sort of ambassador.
Oh, well, he'd be for Britain or for Huddersfield.
he's the Bobby Charlton of Huddersfield, right?
Yeah, quite right. He'll be appointing the next manager.
Right, how about some quick hits? Norwich scrap and get a point as City huff and puff, but fail to blow down Alex Neil's house. Hughesy, do these two drop points mean City's title challenge is now over? And don't say it was over before last week.
I don't think it ever started, did it? They've not been challenging all season. They've been off the pace. They can't string together successive wins, underachieving hugely. It's just as well they've got past, well, they look like they're going to get past Kiev this week. Otherwise, the season really would be over.
They did win the League Cup, though. Everton joined Watford, Crystal Palace, and the winner of the Manchester United v West Ham replay in the semi-final after beating Chelsea 2-0, and Romelu Lukaku scores a wonder goal. Roy, he is 25 on the season. Can you name me three Premier League centre-forwards you'd rather have on your team? And also, does this help dispel some of the clouds over your mate Roberto Martinez?
The answer to the second bit is yes, definitely. It was a really strong performance from Everton. Very intense, which is what they've lacked at home, I think, and it did feel like a kind of big psychological barrier that both that Martinez and the players spoke about, kind of getting over this mental block of playing in front of quite a fractious Goodison Park crowd. Three other strikers I'd rather have ahead of Lukaku. No, I can't. Aguero, and that's it.
Sturridge?
Oh, Kane. Yeah, Aguero and Kane.
It's clearly Roberto Martinez motivated by your
I don't even know if I'd have Kane over Lukaku.
In that very same game, Diego Costa got himself sent off and everybody went nuts for at least 24 hours, suggesting he had taken a big bite out of good old Gareth Barry. Cass, it seems he did not, in fact, bite Barry. Barry himself said so. And when I saw the TV pictures, I'm like, what bite? I mean, he's opening his mouth and he's putting it in another man's neck. And unless it's an amorous romantic moment, it's not something you should really ever do. But did we make way too big a deal out of this simply because it is Diego Costa?
Well, I think, first and foremost, Gareth Barry done brilliant for him because coming out and making the comments he did, it was quite a creepy moment. It felt quite uncomfortable, didn't it, when you watch it again and you sort of think, he's nearly kissed him.
Did you ever play against somebody who tried to do that to you? Like maybe went and like sort of like licked your neck or gave you like a little a hickey or something? No, because I would imagine if you were marking somebody on a defensive corner.
I had a love bite, but I did. Wasn't
from who?
From a player when I was playing France. A lad had sort of bit and sort of sucked a bit, and I had this mark on my neck afterwards. But
which you had to explain to the missus.
Them days, no. I just said I got a bite during the game, but it was one of them. It was a moment that was. Am I going to have 25 seconds here to finish this love bite story?
This obviously makes him uncomfortable. clearly.
But
you didn't throw yourself to the ground screaming.
I didn't feel like a natural big bite like Suarez had done.
Which is obvious, which is how Barry would have reacted if he'd bitten him. Right. Harry Kane bags two goals as Spurs beat Villa to keep the heat on Leicester. But Hughesy, I'd rather ask you about the stewards forcibly removing two banners, one anti-Randy Lerner, one anti-Tom Fox. It's kind of over the top, isn't it? I mean, I realize he owns the club and therefore the stadium, so it's technically his house. And if somebody came into your house in Sheen and started posting sort of Hughesy out banners, you'd probably whoop him. But
what, you mean my wife?
Exactly. But still, it's not really helping, right?
No, it is. So it is over the top stewarding, but it's not not unusual. We've seen it at Arsenal, we've seen it at Man United. Any dissent is clamped down on. I think it's a little bit embarrassing. But I can sort of empathise with the Villa fans. I mean, they've had such a miserable season. They've got no hope. They're relegated. The club is a complete mess. Kind of, you know, daubing some words on a pillowcase is probably all they can do.
Remy Gard has another 3 years after this one.
Well, he doesn't, does he? He'll be gone.
No, but I just find it extraordinary that you would give somebody a 3.5-year contract. You can probably count on one hand the number of managers who deserve contracts more than 2 years. And Remy Gard isn't one of them. Not when your team's in danger of relegation. Bournemouth down Swansea 3-2 as one Steve Cook notches the winner for the second straight home game, I believe. Rory, they're going to stay up. Can you please illustrate some of the broader implications and lessons to be learned by the Cherries' experience?
You don't make too many changes to a team that wins promotion, particularly one that does so in...
And if you do make changes, make sure they all get injured so they never play.
Yes, exactly. Although I think what they did was actually quite impressive. They kind of said, right, we're not going to do that thing where we're going to go and sign 11 new players for £3 million each. We're going to go and spend £8 million on Matt Stradle, £10 million here, £12 million on Afobe. We're going to go and buy quality to supplement what we already have.
Mings
was obviously very unfortunate,
right.
Losing Callum Wilson as well was a massive blow.
Yeah.
But no, it's brilliant for Bournemouth that they stayed up, have a plan, have a style, stick to it, believe in yourselves, go forth and multiply, I don't know, loads of stuff.
If you were Newcastle, would you have been better off throwing a whole, just accepting relegation or whatever happens, and then throwing a whole wad of cash at Eddie Howe in the summer?
I can see why you'd say that, and there'll come a point where Eddie Howe starts getting offered big jobs. I just wonder with Howe whether it's one of those things where it's kind of manager and club working in perfect harmony, and that he might not be able to replicate that success elsewhere. I don't know.
I'm sure he appreciates you saying that. The handsome and talented Graziano Pelle scores two as Southampton beat Stoke, but referee John Moss takes the headline again. He sends offside Domane for no apparent reason whatsoever and doesn't give a penalty when Jack Butland takes out Dusan Tadic in a classic foul plus accentuating dive situation. Cass, your verdict?
Well, obviously on the sending off, Mane's, it was bordering on ridiculous. It's quite clear there's no elbow involved. It's not intentional, and he catches him with his head. And on the other decision, I just thought it was typical of where we are in the game. That it's, for me, that was one of the most blatant of the weekend, and yet was waved on.
Gab, one for you. Fascinating column for you today,
really,
on Laurent Blanc.
Wasn't it?
Superb. Is he really an A-list manager now? PSG have won their fourth straight title?
Not quite yet, in my opinion. And it's obviously not the title, but he's actually won 9 of 10 domestic competitions since taking over Paris Saint-Germain. By any measure, you know, even with all his resources, that is impressive. He's actually done better than Ancelotti, who you all seem to love, as do I, of course. He's done well, I think, in the Champions League. You know, quarterfinal defeat to Chelsea, probably undeserved 2 years ago. Last year they ran into Barcelona, and then the quarterfinals again this year. But I think most of all, he's shown that he came in as fifth or sixth choice, and he's managed to sort of add some discipline to the squad and flex some muscles, which, supposedly being the super nice guy he is, and the soft touch that he is, he wasn't able to do. So I think he's definitely somebody who's grown into the job. Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many thanks to my excellent guests today, Tony Cascarino, Matt Hughes, and from somewhere in suburban Greater Manchester, it's Rory K. Smith, sitting next to a large box of women's clothes, as we've discovered. Please press that subscribe button. We're going to be back next week. But remember, you can get exclusive football highlights free as part of your subscription. It's just £12 for a 12-week trial. Just search The Times online. Till next time, bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.